Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Every single person around this administration, when asked a direct question about contacts with Russians, has lied about it.
There have been a lot of Russian operatives, a lot of Russian oligarchs who have been involved with the president.
But if you're in President Trump's position, who he was as a businessman, a guy who was bankrupt at least four times, you don't have a lot of lending options.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man who doesn't like national monuments unless they're to him, Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. So the Trump propaganda line has shifted again. No collusion is out. Collusion isn't illegal, is in. Here's a timeline of the positions on the Russian scandal taken by Trump, his spokespeople, and Sean Hannity. But I repeat myself. The first line, which lasted from July 2016 until February of this year, was that the Trump campaign had no contact with Russia. In February, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was still saying, "This is a non-story because to the best of our knowledge, no contacts took place." That line broke down in March, with news reports about all the contacts between Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak and Jared Kushner, Michael Flynn, Jeff Sessions, Carter Page, and on and on. The line that replaced it was contact, but no collusion. Sure, there were lots of meetings with the Russians now that we think about it, but we didn't do anything with them. That line lasted until July, and the revelation of Don Jr.'s Trump Tower meeting with Russians offering dirt on Hillary Clinton. The new third line, which went from July through the end of the summer, was, "We were just collusion curious." What politician wouldn't want to sample imported dirt about his opponents? And then the fourth line, which really got going in October and November, with just fake news, fake news, fake news. There was collusion by the Clintons. And now that seems to be giving way to a fifth official Trump line, which emerged just this week. Collusion isn't a crime. That's what Trump's lawyers are now saying. They also claim the president can't be guilty of obstruction of justice. When the president does it, that means it's not illegal. That was Richard Nixon's comment to David Frost after Watergate. To be honest, I'm not sure where they can take it from here. Once the president declares himself to be beyond the law, that's pretty much the end of the road. I'll be back to discuss L'Affaire Russe with the journalist Luke Harding, who's written the first book about it. But first, I want you to listen to these comments from Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who denies reports that he's leaving his post.
Good afternoon. Last week, the New York Times reported that I am likely to be leaving the State Department soon and that my replacement is rumored to be Mike Pompeo. I've been instructed to let you know that this is not true and to offer some further denials of things that have recently been attributed to me. So I did not recently buy a large boat and several months worth of rations and sea navigation manuals. I did not christen the boat Sweet Freedom and have those words painted on the side. It's not true that on a recent call with the Chinese foreign minister, I was heard to say, quote, "Never mind the trade agreement. What do you know about using only the stars to plot a course on the open sea?" It's not true that I recently sent flowers to my wife at her place of employment with a card that read, quote, "Just hang on a few more weeks, Renda. Soon we'll have all the time in the world and nothing but the sounds of the ocean," end quote. It's not true that I've been heard to shout, quote, this is a goddamned sinking ship and I'm getting off it, you Putin-loving autocrat, into the telephone at the end of phone calls with the president. In short, I am here at the State Department to stay, and I've given no one any reason to think otherwise. No questions at this time.
C-Rex was written and performed by Steve Waltin. My guest today is the journalist Luke Harding. He works for The Guardian in London. And boys, he had an amazing career. He was the correspondent in Russia about a decade ago. He got kicked out, and then he was at the center of The Guardian's coverage of the WikiLeaks story, of the Snowden story, and now he is covering the Trump-Russia story. His new book is Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. Needless to say, it's a paperback. Luke, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hello. Thank you.
Well, I guess the question, we're doing a book like this, is when to stop. I mean, amazingly, you're current through the George Papadopoulos plea bargain, which was just a month ago. But how did the publisher finally rip this out of your hands?
Well, so I'm published in New York by Sonny Mater, who's something of a kind of legend. And we had a series of conspiratorial meetings in New York and also in London discussing how to make this work. And of course, mindful of the fact that following Trump, it's sort of like chasing a tornado, really. But when I wrote the book, what I wanted to do was to kind of contextualize and to kind of bring the Russian side of the story to this whole conversation. Obviously, the American players are fairly familiar, but the Russians kind of less so. And so I kind of did it almost character by character, chapter by chapter, and I had to kind of rewrite a chunk that I'd written earlier in the year later on. And of course, when Robert Mueller, the special counsel, issued his first round of indictments against Paul Manafort, George Papadopoulos, and so on, at that point, Sonny Mater said, okay, stop, let's rush the book out. So I spent the night rewriting the epilogue, sent it all off, and it was literally at the printers within a matter of days. And just one last thing, this was all in secret, nothing going via email, everything being delivered a bit sort of John le Carré style by stick, with kind of handoffs and secret meetings of our own. And I think in the end it worked, and we're very pleased with the outcome.
Why did you need the secrecy? Why didn't you want anyone to know the book was coming?
Well, primarily because I've sort of been through the mincer in Russia. I mean, I was expelled from Russia in 2011, and the Kremlin took umbrage at a series of articles I wrote about Vladimir Putin's money, about the murder of Alexander Litvinenko, who was the Russian dissident poisoned in 2006 with a radioactive cup of tea. And he was the subject of my previous book. And my phone was hacked in the spring. I've had problems with email before. And so we were just worried that someone might take this stuff or leak this stuff or interfere with this stuff or delete this stuff. So we were very circumspect.
You put the dossier and Christopher Steele, the former MI6 officer who's the author of the so-called dossier, at the center of the story. And unlike a lot of journalists here, you take what's in the dossier very seriously. I mean, much of the book is devoted to confirming significant portions of it. But let's just talk about Steele and the dossier a little bit at the outset, because it's been received in such different ways. I mean, some publications haven't touched it. You know, I think Bob Woodward here called it trash, said journalists shouldn't have anything to do with it. In general, it's been treated at the very least skeptically, on the assumption that, well, while Christopher Steele may have done everything in good faith, there's a lot of rumor and things passed on, and great parts of it almost certainly are not completely true. That's not your approach to it. Why not?
Well, for a number of reasons. I mean, firstly, I met with Chris Steele in December of last year, about 4 weeks before BuzzFeed published the dossier on January the 10th. And secondly, I've talked extensively to kind of friends of his and asked those same questions. How can we take it seriously and so on? And the answer I get from Steele is basically to point out that he is a professional with a long and credible track record. He spent 22 years working in British intelligence for MI6, three of them as a kind of junior spy in Soviet Moscow, where he saw the collapse of communism firsthand, stood meters away from the tank where Boris Yeltsin famously in 1991 denounced a coup by the KGB. And he's someone who understands the Russian bureaucracy and its Soviet predecessor, and also who has kind of secret sources. And this is the key point, is that you talk to Steele about this, and he sort of says that the sources behind his dossier were the same sources that he used in previous reporting, which had nothing to do with Donald Trump. Primarily, for example, a series of reports that he authored after 2014 on the war in Ukraine, which were well received by U.S. intelligence and were shared in the statement inside the State Department right up until John Kerry. In other words, and those sources were right about what was going on in Ukraine and Putin's kind of covert war there. Logically, it doesn't make sense for those sources to then be completely wrong about Donald Trump. And of course, everything that we now know that's happened over the last year has, in my view, sort of further confirmed what he wrote.
I mean, Steele, it sounds like he took this on as a job, and in a lot of ways it became a cause, right? I mean, he has his own consulting firm and works for pay for clients, who many of whom are corporations, and he was hired by another consultant, this Fusion GPS firm in Washington, which seems that it'll work happily for any side that will pay them. But so he was hired to compile this. I think he probably did not know that it was people connected to Hillary Clinton who were paying for the dossier, at least by the time he got to working on that part of it. But then what he found made him sort of go beyond the client work, right?
Well, that's correct. He didn't know who the ultimate client was. He merely, in spring of 2016, initially began looking at Paul Manafort, Trump's sort of soon-to-be campaign manager, and then the kind of broader question of what links does Donald Trump have to Russia, specifically financial money, etc. And he basically funneled out this question to his various secret sources and then waited for the replies. And the replies, when he got them, he told friends who I've spoken to, were hair-raising. You know, one quote from Steele, reading this stuff is a life-changing experience. And what his sources were telling him in Moscow was that essentially that there had been a kind of collusional relationship between Team Trump and between Russia and Russian intelligence going back at least 5 years, with a kind of transactional arrangement where the sort of Trump camp would supply the Kremlin with useful tidbits of information about the activities of Russian oligarchs in the United States, bearing in mind that Putin is a very paranoid person. He wants to know everything about what billionaires are doing, whether they're plotting against him and so on. And in return, the Russians were kind of helping and furthering Trump's political career. And that reached a kind of superlative stage last year when the Kremlin, this is what US intelligence said, hacked Democratic Party emails, and they were dumped out via Julian Assange and WikiLeaks at moments of maximum embarrassment against Hillary Clinton. Now, that is the kind of dossier thesis, and I think, of course, there are reservations about it. It's raw intelligence, but I think basically that is what happened.
Let me bring up two issues with it that people have raised that are interesting. One is that the collusion theory gives Putin too much credit, that Russian intelligence involves a great deal of bumbling and incompetence and internal politics. And this story almost portrays them as geniuses and master manipulators, and that's not really how things work. What do you say to that?
I broadly agree with that kind of view. I mean, Putin is not Superman. He's not a kind of evil uber gremlin who sits in a cave and flicks over buttons and presses red switches and makes things happen in a kind of minutely controlled way. He is an opportunist who takes advantage of the situation before him. And what he found in the United States, what was a deeply kind of polarized situation, and with one candidate, Donald Trump, who was a kind of effective vehicle for discrediting Hillary Clinton, whom, by the way, Putin thought would win the election. And what was kind of unleashed was actually relatively low tech, phishing emails, rattling the doors of servers, seeing what you could get, plus a kind of classic espionage operation, similar, not dissimilar to the ones that Putin himself ran during the Cold War years, in which Russian intelligence officers tried to get very close to Trump's inner circle, and let's face it, didn't meet very much resistance. We now know that Russian assets met with George Papadopoulos, allegedly, that's from Mueller's indictment, that a Russian lawyer bearing gifts took a meeting in Trump Tower with Donald Trump Jr., with Paul Manafort, with Jared Kushner, And we know that Michael Cohen, Trump's personal lawyer, fired off a sort of begging email, basically, to Dmitry Peskov, Trump's press secretary, asking for help to build a tower, and so on. And so it's not that Putin is a genius, it's that he's very good at exploiting the weakness of the other side.
You do a terrific job making this into a narrative, telling the story around the people and the theory of the collusion. But another problem with it is there are too many good theories. I mean, there's collusion via Paul Manafort, via Carter Page, via Papadopoulos, via Michael Flynn, via the Trump Tower meeting you were just talking about. And it's sort of overdetermined. Well, you could say it's overdetermined, and they're not mutually exclusive. On the other hand, there are sort of too many good theories for all of them to be true, and it points maybe to a kind of wishful thinking.
Well, I completely reject that. I think that's wrong. And I think it's that argument is based on almost complete ignorance of Russian and Soviet methods. And speaking as someone who knows the Russian language, who lived there, who suffered from kind of break-ins at my family apartment where I was living with my wife and kids. And we found out from the British Embassy that we had kind of bugs in our walls and video as well. I think it's quite possible to be empirical about what the Kremlin does and what it doesn't do, and also about its broader geopolitical objectives. So I don't think we should get too focused on process, how the dossier came about, who paid for it, or let ourselves be distracted by different theories. I think we just need to be kind of evidential, in the same way that Robert Mueller is. And let's face it, we've had four people indicted already. If there was nothing to see here, I don't think Donald Trump would be so terrified by this story, by wouldn't sort of tweet so remorselessly and be waging the ongoing campaign he is against the FBI. There is a version of the truth, or the truth, let's call it. Some of it is known, some of it we have yet to find out, and that the Russian half is very well buried, but I think we will get there.
So put another way, which theory does Donald Trump have the most to fear from, or I guess I should say, which potentially cooperating witness does he have the most to fear from? Is it Michael Flynn, or do you think it's still Manafort, or maybe someone else we haven't heard from yet?
Well, that's it. There's a kind of parallel answer to this. I mean, he's got quite a lot of fear from Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn was a senior advisor to the campaign from late 2015 onwards. Meanwhile, zipping off to Moscow for this dinner meeting for a Russia Today gala where he sat next to Vladimir Putin. Paul Manafort knows everything, but so far as I can tell, I think is being pretty kind of stalwart. And the game that Paul Manafort is playing, it seems to me, is to angle for a presidential pardon by getting his lawyer to say there's no collusion, there's nothing to see here, this is all fake, in the hope that he might be absolved of all of this.
He's hanging tough at the moment, in the Nixon terminology. Yeah,
he's hanging tough, and also I met him. I mean, I have a whole chapter about what he did in Ukraine, which is where I first encountered him back in 2008. And I would say of the Trump team, he's probably the cleverest. But he's also someone who's utterly unscrupulous and immoral. And we've seen in the past he's denied things which have turned out to be true. And then he just kind of modulates his falsehood, I would allege, to suit the circumstances. But the person that Donald Trump really has to fear isn't an American, it's a Russian, and it's Vladimir Putin, because Putin will know precisely to what degree Trump has or hasn't colluded, not just now, but also historically. He'll have been appraised of the KGB operation in the 1980s when Trump was invited to Soviet Moscow to talk about real estate possibilities and hotels, and when basically the Soviet government issued the invitation and took care of all of the arrangements, and no doubt would have bugged him when he was staying in a hotel in Red Square. And the exquisiteness of Putin's position is that he can turn the dial up or turn the dial down. And what you have to ask yourself, I mean, people of the left or of the right who are skeptical about the whole kind of collusion notion is I wonder what their answer is to the question of why is Donald Trump so consistently nice about Vladimir Putin when he's so rude about practically everybody else on the planet? I mean, how does one explain that?
And you've always, you take the relatively simple explanation of compromise, that Putin has stuff on him that Trump doesn't want out.
Yeah, Putin has a lot of stuff on him. I mean, there'll be a dossier on Trump going back to, certainly, I would say, to the 1970s when Trump married Ivana, a woman from communist Czechoslovakia. We know from declassified files in Prague that the Czechoslovak secret police kept a very close eye on the Trumps in Manhattan, that they had regular chats with Trump's then father-in-law, then this kind of this invitation, which I think is crucial, in 1987, which was arranged by Interest, the Soviet state travel agency, which is basically the KGB. And that's what defectors, KGB defectors have told me. And they bring Trump over. And it's a kind of look-see. It seems to me, and to my sources, a kind of classic cultivation operation. And Trump certainly met the requirements that the KGB was looking for back then in terms of personality, that they circulated a sort of secret questionnaire for KGB residents abroad. That's the kind of the head of station, like the sort of CIA chief. And the people they were interested in were vain, were narcissistic, were greedy, were poor analysts, were suggestible. That really is Donald Trump on every single measure. So there will be a huge file on him, supplemented with more recent material, including from 2013, and a lot of technical stuff collected by the FSB, including, no doubt, video of Trump in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, as per the Steele dossier. Now, whether Trump watched an exotic show featuring prostitutes or whether he went to bed early with a French novel, we don't know.
But you don't dismiss what's in the dossier, the so-called P tape. I mean, you think that is plausible.
It's what the FSB and the KGB does. It's been doing it for decades. And this is what I'm saying about a lot of people who don't like this stuff are kind of behaving or thinking acontextually, that there's a huge literature of KGB entrapment measures. There's even a name for the beautiful young women who were sent to seduce Western diplomats, American diplomats in the 60s and 70s. They were called swallows, rather poetic. I've talked to former intelligence officers who have traveled on an empty Trans-Siberian express train and find, you know, a 25-year-old model in the bunk above, very flirtatious, keen to practice her English. I mean, this has been going on forever. There's nothing new about it. The only question is not whether there's a tape, but what Trump did.
And how could that actually be used? I mean, I can understand how that would produce pressure on Donald Trump to act in a certain way, assuming, of course, that he's not just acting that way out of pure belief, which is also possible. But
sure,
the FSB can't release that tape because it would be clear that they had released it. I mean, they at that point, they're acknowledging spying on everybody who comes to Russia, which, as you say, they do. But would there be any kind of precedent for them actually using that kind of material by making it public?
Yeah, they've used it all the time.
And against Russians.
Against Russians. But the point is, this is one pressure point. There are other pressure points as well. But that it may exist, of course, is embarrassing. But it gives, obviously, Putin the upper hand. But there's also the whole kind of financial question about what financial deals Trump may have cut in the past, especially when he was in kind of a tight spot in terms of cash. And when Trump says no deals, no loans, with Russia, nothing. That's kind of formally true, because despite trying for 30 years, he never managed to build his hotel in Moscow. But the question is the reverse. How much right. Russian money went into the Trump organization? We know from 2008 that Donald Trump Jr. said we have a disproportionate number of our clients come from Russia. And that there's been lots of analysis by Reuters and others showing huge numbers of Russian passport holders buying Trump real estate, some of it in branded properties. And the big question for Robert Mueller is how much of this was money laundering and how much of this may have been surreptitious assistance to Donald Trump himself.
So if the collusion theory is right, the Russians have, well, first succeeded beyond their wildest dreams, but then in another way, it's completely backfired on them. Because this has become so public, Trump can't help them in the way he might otherwise have done. He can't undo the sanctions. He can't be as openly friendly as he might otherwise be. In fact, he can't be as openly friendly as another American president, not Hillary Clinton, but some other newly elected president might be in trying to establish better relations with Russia, because he's under this cloud of suspicion of collusion.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. And I think the scorecard for Putin is mixed, but it's broadly in his favor. Yes, you're right. I mean, it looked at one point when Trump became was elected president that he would lift sanctions on Russia, which is what Putin wants. And of course, this scandal exploded to such a degree that's become politically impossible. And I think, like I said, Putin expected Trump to lose. Trump won. And that was a kind of good outcome. But I think the Kremlin in general has a poor understanding of American institutional politics. It tends to think that the US is like Russia and didn't really factor in the fact that there's Congress, there's a kind of vociferous media, that there are senators looking over their shoulders and looking at the poll numbers, and that Trump's room for maneuver is relatively limited. So he didn't get sanctions. That's a kind of ongoing disappointment. But what he has got is an America that is hyper-polarized, that is being sort of stirred up practically every morning by Trump on issues of race, ethnicity, gender, just with a sort of broiling, almost culture war, if you like. And that, of course, is all to Putin's advantage, because it means with America sort of self-focused and more or less absent from the international stage, that Putin can do what he wants in the Middle East, in Syria, in Ukraine. He can seek to influence election results in Europe like he did in the US last year. And he's in a kind of fantastically strong position. And what's more, he knows it.
Do you have a sense of whether Chris Steele is cooperating in any way with the Mueller investigation?
Well, that's an interesting question. Let's put it this way. I think it would be incredible if people from Mueller's team had not spoken to Chris Steele.
And Steele's in an interesting position now. I mean, he's just sort of waiting for vindication, if your book is mostly right. What is the piece of evidence or the shoe that could drop that would really make the people who were very skeptical of Steele say, all right, we now have to acknowledge that he basically had it right?
Well, I mean, there are more shoes than fit on a millipede. But I mean, the thing that strikes me most obviously after the legal document we got from Mueller on Friday of last week is that clearly Flynn talked to, it seems, to Jared Kushner to get a approval for what you might call a kind of highly accommodationist policy towards Russia, to stop Putin from reciprocating when Obama kicked out Russian diplomats by kicking out American diplomats. But the question is Kushner the great brain behind this operation, or is, of course, Kushner taking instruction from his dad-in-law, and that actually the person driving these back channels, these meetings, is Trump himself? And so I think that is very perilous for Trump. But I also think the kind of whole financial side is very perilous. I was quite interested, story by Bloomberg this morning out of Frankfurt, the fact that Deutsche Bank, which has lent $300 million to Donald Trump, has finally, under subpoena, turned over these records to Mueller and to the special counsel's office, because we've been asking Deutsche Bank for a year to try and shed some light on why it lent so much money to Donald Trump, given the fact that in 2008, Trump...
He stiffed them and sued them, yeah.
Defaulted on a $45 million loan, stiffed them with the most ridiculous and surreal writ that I've ever seen, basically saying that Deutsche Bank co-created the financial crisis and therefore he wasn't going to pay them anything, and they owed him $3 billion.
We call that chutzpah in New York. Yes.
Well, it's beyond that. Yeah. I mean, we talk to people in Deutsche Bank. I don't know if I can use expletives on your podcast. When I said
you may.
I may. Okay. Where you said, you know, is this normal for a bank to do this? And one Deutsche Bank source told us, are you fucking kidding me? It's not normal. It's highly abnormal. And Deutsche Bank lent him more money to pay off the money he defaulted on to Deutsche Bank, a different division. And meanwhile, while all this was going on, Deutsche Bank Moscow had essentially been captured by the Russian security services, the FSB, and was laundering $10 billion for VIP clients in Moscow into the US financial system. Now we know this because there's been a report by the New York Department of Financial Services that fined Deutsche Bank about $450 million for this money laundering scheme. So you have money laundering in Moscow and very curious lending patterns to Donald Trump in New York from the same bank. So there's that, but there's a ton of other stuff as well. I mean, enough to keep Mueller and his team busy for a very long time.
Well, we're looking forward to Collusion 2, but in the meantime, I recommend Collusion, which is Luke Harding's new book. Luke, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Our sketch, C-Rex, was written and performed by Steve Waltine. And hey, for those of you who are already addicted to Slow Burn, the new podcast Slate is doing about Watergate, the second episode is up. Check it out. Today's show was produced by Jason DeLeon. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.